Welcome to Shattering Myths, the program that is devoted to the largest segment of society, to those of you who have come to realize that all of the world's religious, political, economic, and military institutions are corrupt, counterproductive, and cannot be fixed. I am Yada. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate anytime over the next 2 hours, is 877-300-7645. I was going to begin in Afghanistan, but I can't let the comment by the Democratic congressman go without a comment. He said that the Republican budget did not reflect American values. And as his example, he says that it targets food stamps. Therefore, we must assume that he holds food stamps as the highest in American values. He doesn't hold hard work, industry, free enterprise as American values. He doesn't value family as an American value. He doesn't value a sense of fair play, industry, inventiveness, dedication, compassion.
None of those things get him a vote.
Intellect, reason, none of those things are American value. What's an American value is a plain Robin Hood. My friend Scott, it's if you take through force and threat, stealing money from those who are productive and give it to those who are not productive, 75 million Americans taking advantage of food stamps. You know, my top guy at our farm in Virginia, guy's been with us for about, I guess now about 15 years, as a farm manager back there. He came up through a really rough childhood. His mother, an addict, probably both alcohol and illegal drugs. And very, very rough. And mom doesn't work. Sister doesn't work. Ex-girlfriend doesn't work. And they're all dependents on the state. The state pays for everything. And so she was living in a state-provided domicile. Doing nothing, receiving food stamps and receiving everything else that you can imagine. And, you know, her contribution to society is she has done everything she can do to abuse her son, my friend and worker here on our farm. And recently she asked her son who's done everything he can to stay away from her because she's just trouble, as is everyone who lives with her. And, you know, he's a recovering alcoholic, done a marvelous job of turning his life around. And they go back to the mother's house, which is filled with all kinds of indulgences, is a bad environment for him. And amazing that, of course, that someone who is dependent on the government to provide for their housing and for their food and all other manners of assistance has the money to have satellite television, to have a smartphone and related plan, to have a vehicle, and to be able to have the cupboards filled with alcohol and to be able to buy drugs. But nonetheless, that's I guess part of the American values.
That's weird, huh?
Yeah, she's moving because the government is the state of Virginia is going to provide her with a much nicer apartment, absolutely free to her. We are rewarding disgusting, perverted behavior. We are rewarding a complete depravity of character, all while we are punishing those who seek to actually earn an honest living and take care of their families. Those are the American values today. The congressman is right. America is wrong, however, and he is wrong, but his label is correct. It's one of a thousand reasons why America cannot be saved.
Yeah, and I'm all for helping people. Like, I want to help people. I like helping people. what it's got to be. It can't. You can't force me to do it. It's got to be something that, like.
Are you helping someone by providing them with federal assistance when it causes them to not work and to spend their day doing negative, harmful behaviors?
No. And I've known that if you give something to someone, they don't
and
take care of it like they would if they had to earn it.
Particularly if you call it an entitlement.
Yeah. Well, they don't take care of it like they would if they had to earn it. I always, for myself, when I had to buy my own shoes, I was very, or when I, my dad bought me shoes as a kid, I was very hard on my shoes. I'd run through puddles. They'd get soaking wet. They'd be dirty all the time. And then when I started buying my own shoes, all of a sudden I noticed my shoes lasted a lot longer because running through a puddle wasn't that important to me.
Yeah.
And same with like a bike. The first bike that my dad bought me, I didn't take very good care of it. It eventually, it got stolen or something. And I didn't even care. But when I had to buy the next bike, all of a sudden that bike I took pretty good care of. And if you just give people things, I don't think they take care of them.
And ultimately you destroy their character. Because we are really crafted to work, to make sacrifices, to engage, to prosper and grow. Those who do nothing, those who are so idle that they poison their minds and bodies with drugs and alcohol, just to numb the pain associated with the feeling and the realization that they're worthless, that they do nothing. I mean, I'm telling you that an individual who just consumes alcohol and doesn't make any contribution knows their value. And we have created an environment that fosters that. Now, it's one thing as a society to be compassionate in the sense of providing shelter for those who are homeless. Yeah, you know, we should in every community have homeless shelters. You know, they should be dry, they should have beds, they should have laboratory facilities and showers and the ability for a person who is homeless to stay there and take care of their place. We should have kitchens that provide food for those who are hungry. You know, we should provide emergency medical care for someone who is injured. Should we provide free for somebody that has a cold and wants to go to a hospital because they have a cold? No. Should we do bypass surgery for someone who can't pay for it? Of course not. Should we provide a $1 million treatment for somebody that isn't able to pay for it? Of course, no. No. But should we provide care for, that within reason? Absolutely. But that's not our, and we should do so in a manner that you don't give people money. That instead you provide shelter. Instead you provide opportunity in terms of educational training. That you provide an opportunity even to work in those shelters, to work in those kitchens, to make a contribution. And I don't even have a problem with some of the government-sponsored work programs if you can't find a job in the private sector, then why not provide people with the opportunity to have a job maintaining parks? I mean, there's lots of things, running daycare, attributing or contributing to daycare centers so that others who have children can go out and search for jobs. I mean, there's lots of things we can do that have nothing to do with redistributing wealth, which is what we have become. We've become a communist country, actually in the fascist mode where there is private ownership. But wealth redistribution is massive in this country. It's something like 80% of 70% of the federal budget. You can't called the Department of War, part of the wealth distribution. But if you pull that out, then about 80% of the rest of it is wealth redistribution, stealing from those who are productive, giving it to those who are unproductive, rewarding failure, punishing success. That is the new American value, according to the congressman. It's a broken country. Speaking of breaking countries, the United States invaded Afghanistan on a pile of lies. You know, there were no Afghans that were involved in 9/11. Not a single Afghani was involved in 9/11. We didn't invade Saudi Arabia, and most of the 9/11 suicide bombers came from Saudi Arabia. We didn't go bomb the Al-Quds Mosque in Hamburg, Germany, and yet a disproportionate number of those who perpetrated 9/11 were worshippers in that mosque in Hamburg, Germany. We didn't go there. We didn't attack Islam, even though that was the only common denominator among all the participants at 9/11. We didn't go and hold Ramzi Youssef accountable, even though it was his plan. And we knew it for certain, and that we had him in custody for the first bombing of the World Trade Center. No, a pile of lies, we decided to invade Afghanistan. We didn't tell America, of course, that our invasion of Afghanistan would be in opposition to the Taliban, the very religious organization that America armed and aided during the 1980s to fight a proxy war against the Soviet Union, that they were once our ally. We didn't tell them that. We didn't tell them that Al-Qaeda was part of that alliance and that all the way up to the President of the United States, we provided weapons and money to Al-Qaeda. We didn't tell them that if we attack Afghanistan, we would simply push the most fundamentalist Muslims out of Afghanistan into Pakistan, where we would destabilize that country. We didn't tell the American people that by attacking the Taliban, we were attacking Pakistan, because Pakistan created the Taliban and still controls it. We just invaded on a pile of lies, and we made a bad situation worse. The story out of Afghanistan yesterday underscores that. An Islamic mullah blamed a woman falsely for burning the Quran, and she, in turn, was burned to death. An Afghan woman was lynched. She was beaten with bats. She was burned alive. She was pulled behind primitive vehicles, dragged through the streets. The mob that killed her because a mullah falsely accused her of burning a Quran. Now, let's say she did burn a Quran. What sane individual, what moral individual, what human would burn a person alive for burning a book? You know, I've read so many goddamn morons telling us that, you know, that Charlie Hebo had it coming. You know, you're stupid to insult a religion. When you insult a religion, you know what they're going to do. No, that is just repulsive. This idea that, you know, she shouldn't have been in a situation where she could be accused of burning a Quran. She would have known that burning a Quran was going to incite violence. God damn. I'm using the term literally. What in the hell is wrong with you folks that take that kind of view? Beyond the fact this woman did nothing wrong, imagine if she had burned the Quran. So what? Who of you out there has a favorite book and someone go burn that book that you would think that the appropriate response would be to burn them alive? My favorite book is the Torah. You can go get 1,000 copies of it. And you can go and make the biggest bonfire you want of the Torah. not only am I not going to burn you alive, I'm not going to touch you. I don't give a hoot what you do. Plenty more copies where that came from. You know, we have reached a point where it appears that virtually no one is capable of exercising good judgment. And virtually no one is capable of being moral. When this occurs, and you realize that this has never occurred in the history of Afghanistan. Yes, the Taliban, when they were in charge of Afghanistan, they would occasionally, about once a year, stone a woman for adultery. They never burn anybody alive. The conditions for women in Afghanistan are vastly worse, and the overall conditions in that country are vastly worse than when we invaded. Terrorism is hugely increased. The narcotics trade, hugely increased. The treatment of women, far more deplorable than it was previously. We made a bad situation worse, and we're still there. We've squandered thousands of American lives, hundreds of thousands of Afghani lives, trillions of dollars, all to make a bad situation worse on a pile of lies. I mean, if you are a patriotic American, wake up. If you are pro-military, open your eyes. If you're still capable of being moral, where is your righteous indignation against Islam? This was a senior religious leader in Afghanistan. He was a mullah. He was a fundamentalist Muslim. He wasn't a radical Muslim. He wasn't an extremist Muslim. He was just a Muslim cleric. This woman was accusing this cleric of superstition. And this mullah had this made money on the side by selling charms to women. And these were magical charms that he would sell to women. So he was a fundamentalist Muslim cleric selling magical charms to women. And if you might say, wait a minute, how can you have a magical charm in Islam? Isn't it a monotheistic Abraham faith? Well, first of all, Abraham didn't have a faith. Abraham didn't have a religion. There's no correlation between Islam and Abraham. And Muhammad was engaged in all sorts of magic charms. Oh, he would tell you that he would comb his hair in a certain way because of the omens. That he would use a certain number of rocks in a certain hand, facing a certain direction, when he had to wipe his bottom. He was all about magic charms. It's integral to Islam. We are going to switch gears because we have an extraordinary individual, really. Some of the favorite emails that I receive over the course of doing this program and writing books like Yada Ya come from this man. He is from the great down under, and I don't mean Texas, but instead Australia. And he is called in probably in the middle of the night in Australia. And it's actually that I encouraged him to call in to talk about his most recent email to me. And I'm going to let Roy introduce the subject of this email. And we'll talk a little bit about why it is so important. Hello, Roy. Thank you very much for getting up in the middle of the night and calling in.
That's all right, Yada. I haven't actually gone to bed yet. It's actually 12:30 in the morning here.
Okay, well, staying up through the middle of the night. Thank you. You sent me an email just a couple of days ago relative to quark confinement, the temperature associated with quark confinement, the age of the universe. What that means in terms of the 6 days of creation. And it was prompted by something that I found quite interesting as well, which is there's a massive black hole very close to the edge of the universe that simply can't exist under the current cosmological model.
Well, that's right, but the edge of the universe is a bit of a problem anyway.
Yes.
As far as we know, you can only see as far as the light that has traveled from that distance will allow you to see. There could
right.
be a further part of the universe beyond that that we can't see. But
just because the light hasn't traveled to that
right.
massive
yes.
distance at this point.
Yeah. So that's one of the problems that the cosmologists have with actually determining the age of the universe. And, of course, this has caused a lot of consternation in the scientific literature because supermassive black holes take a long time to form.
Right.
They don't just
in fact, a black hole that is of this size, a black hole would require a star, a very large star, to exhaust its energy source so that the force that would push the star out ceases. And as the energy source is consumed through fusion, the gravity of that star would have it collapse upon itself. And so for a black hole to exist, that star has to go through its entire life, from creation all the way to death, for that star to create a black hole. And this is a massive black hole, the largest we've ever encountered. And that means it had to be a super massive star, and there's just not enough time for it to have gone through its entire life on the current cosmological model, is there?
Well, it probably wouldn't have survived anyway if it was super massive to start with. It more likely is accreted other stars and sucked them in. But even that's not really the problem here. The sun, for example, is a star that has not enough mass to form anything more than a white dwarf when it finally
right.
burns out. That's
right.
where the gravitational pressure is not sufficient to actually collapse it into a singularity.
Right.
They have a singularity, which means that it just keeps on collapsing, and we just don't know what happens after that point. But when you have that occur, the weight of the star has to be at least around about 4 to 5 solar masses.
Right.
Smaller than that, you can either form a white dwarf or a neutron star. And
this particular star, I don't recall how many magnitudes more massive this black hole is.
Talking about millions or even billions. Now, that's, if you have a look at...
Billions of our suns in terms of mass, correct?
That's right. And that would have had to have been sucked in. Because see, the way that the star collapses is that light itself, even though it's massless, has a momentum associated
right.
with it, and it pushes outwards as it moves out to what's called the random walk process from the sun. So, I mean, where the actual nuclear fusion is going on, it takes up to 1 million years or more, for example, for the light to escape from that point to the photosphere of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really quite staggering.
Right.
About it
is 1 million years for the light to escape just from the place of fusion within a star.
That's right, yes. And then it reaches us in about 8 minutes or thereabouts. So what happens is that the star then, when it's big, collapses upon itself and forms a singularity, but it's still got its gravitational potential there, so it tends to suck other things in. But if you've been watching my recent doco on the Milky Way's black hole, the black hole that's thought to be in the center of the Milky Way. There's apparently a gas cloud that's being sucked into it. Now, the Milky Way black hole has been quite quiet of late, and that's because you can have stars, for example, circulating around or just orbiting around the black hole without being sucked in the same way that the planets revolve around the sun without being sucked in. So the black hole takes quite some time to create enough material to become supermassive.
Correct.
So in other words, this is the basic problem that they have, that there isn't just sufficient time if the universe, which is 13.7 by 10 to the 9 years old, which is what they're saying it is at the moment. So in other words...
Yes, how far is this black hole from the Earth?
Well, it's about 13 by 10 to the 9 light years, edge of the universe.
So 13 times.
Oh, you mean our black hole? Or?
Right. No, this particular black hole is 13 times 10 to the ninth light years away from the Earth, and the universe under the current model, based upon the measure of quark confinement and the cosmic microwave radiation emanating from the Big Bang, is estimated. They took it from 13.4, and about a year ago they took it from 13.4 to 13.7 billion years old. But you can't have a black hole this massive 13 billion years out in a universe that's only 13.7 billion years old.
Well, that would seem to be the case. I'd have to put a caveat on that what no one really knows. It just seems extremely unlikely, I'll put it that way, for the time being. I thought, well, look, let's have a look at what Yah said. Yeah. Yah says that the universe was created in 24-hour period, 6 days.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And when you read Schroeder's The Science of God, for example, he will do a very simple formula, which is that the age of the universe, which he was estimating, I think, around about 15 billion years, and divide that by the expansion factor of the universe. Now, this is where the quark confinement comes in.
I also use 15 billion years, but I use a plus or minus 10%. And the reason I do that is because there are lots of ways to estimate the age of the universe, and if you use all of them collectively, you get it about 15 billion years. And if you pretend, as science is right now, that it's exactly 13.7 billion years, I think you make a fool of yourself. I think the best we can do is to say it appears to be approximately this old, plus or minus 10%.
Well, that's right. I mean, as I pointed out in the email, there's at least three places I got it from, but I couldn't get it from Peebles, incidentally. I've had a close look through his book. I mean, GSU's 10 to 13 degrees Kelvin is the quark confinement. Physics World says it's 2 by 10 to the 12 degrees Kelvin. University of Oregon says it's 10 to the 11 degrees Kelvin.
So, I mean, now, the reason that this is important, and let me try to summarize this, Roy, and you correct me if I misstate it, is that Yahweh says, and we know this to be true, that the universe was created with this enormous blast of energy, and time doesn't flow, so there is no measurement of time when there is simply energy. You have to have, quarks have to be confined. If you have to reach a temperature, cool to a temperature where quarks can be confined, to have energy transition into mass, because it's only with mass that time exists.
Hello?
From the point that where energy is becoming matter, correct?
That's right. Yes. But
the temperature is essential in knowing when that happened. Correct.
That's right. Yeah. But you see, when this happens, then most of the electromagnetic radiation, which was essentially what the energy was prior to quark confinement. It's defined by a factor thing called H, which is Planck's constant, times the frequency. And that's known from laboratory experiments when quark confinement will occur. So what you've got is essentially what's left over in the electromagnetic spectrum, what they call the echo of the Big Bang, is extremely high energy gamma rays. Now, as the universe expands, the gamma rays get their wavelength, if you like, stretched out, because they are in the universe and expanding right along with it. As they expand, their energy level falls. That's per photon. A photon is just simply one bit of the gamma ray, if you like, or bit of light. As that expands, then the energy of that falls, and it's now at 2.73 degrees absolute, or Kelvin. Which is the background cosmic radiation we find. So it's a simple matter of just saying, okay, we know what energy was where the quarks were confined. We know what the current temperature of the background is. The difference is the expansion factor of the universe.
which would determine its age.
Right.
But the problem is we really don't know for certain, and there are three very prominent schools of thought on what was the temperature of quark confinement, because that's the beginning number. And if you don't know that number, then you can be off by as much as a billion years on your estimate of age.
That's right. But you see, if you take the average of what they think it is, and I think that's what Beeble says, it comes to roughly 10 to the 12. I think 9 by 10 to the 11 is probably the best estimate.
Right.
That's the expansion factor. So if you reverse engineer the simple equation that the estimated age of the universe divided by the expansion factor, and multiply that by 365.242, whatever the factor is, that particular days will give
number of days in a year.
Six. It's not exactly six, but it's approximately six.
Yeah.
And that
it's extraordinarily close to six.
Right.
Very, very close. And when you turn that backwards and say, okay, Yah says 6 days, okay, now all you do is you multiply by the expansion factor, turn it back into years, and it turns out to be 14.7 by 10 to the 9.
Yes, and we're going to keep that in mind. Roy, we've got the music playing, which means we're about ready to go to break, but we'll be back after the commercial break. See you guys. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a conversation with Roy from Australia regarding the age of the universe and correlating it to Yahweh's testimony. So you were saying, Roy, that if you just start with Yahweh's testimony and extrapolate from there, that you get 14.7. Now, how did you get that number again?
Well, the formula that is really quite simple. It's just simply, the forward formula, I call that the reverse formula.
Okay.
The forward formula is simply the estimated age of the universe divided by the expansion factor that we've decided from the quark confinement to now equals the number of days that the universe has been in existence. If you're looking at it from the point of view of the creator, of course, this is due to relativity. It could be classified as 6 days. That's another thing that I don't think we mentioned before. The thing is that to me it's extremely interesting that you can take 6 days, plug in the relatively accurate known factor of the expansion factor of the universe, and turn up with a figure that's very close to what most scientists figure out in other ways as to the age of the universe.
As a matter of fact, that 14.7 billion years that you came up with, which is within 2% of the number that I used as the estimate of the age of the universe, and yada yada.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
When you look at the three, now there's another correlation here. You examined the three different popular, well-accepted, if you will, estimates of quark confinement temperature, didn't you? And did the math from that point.
Yes, yes.
And the coolest to the warmest, and then the why don't you go through what those numbers say and what the average of them is?
I haven't done the actual average, but the formula, for example, for GSU is 10 to the 13 degrees Kelvin, which is, if you like, 10 by 10 to the 13. So when you divide 2.27, which is the figure that they give, by 10 to the 12 for quark confinement by 2.73, and then you do the calculation, you end up with 13.7 by 10 to the 12 years.
Right.
10 to the 9 years, that should be, sorry, that's a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Then the second one is 2.44 divided by 2.73 gives you 14.7, and 2.6 divided by 2.73 gives you 15.7. 10 to the 9 years.
13.7, 14.7, and 15.7, depending on which of the three schools that you use for quark confinement temperature.
That's right. So the 14.7 is right slap bang in the middle of it. But I guess it couldn't be far out.
So if you just use Yahweh's testimony, you come up with 14.7 being the age of the universe, which is 6 days. Exactly.
That's right.
6 days, exactly.
When I say that to the people, to the patients that I spoke to about it, I sort of look at you in a bemused way, and I said, okay, so Yah says that the universe has been around for 6 days. Scientists say that it's been around for 15 billion years, or thereabouts. Who's right? What's the correct answer?
Yeah.
And the answer, of course, is both of them are, because it's all relative. Depends upon where you're looking at it from. He's in a, that is, Yah is in an area of an immense energy. So to him, time slows down. We are in an area where the energy is much less, so the time speeds up. So looking forward from his perspective, it's 6 days of creation. Looking backwards from our perspective, it's 14.7 billion years. And that's from our friend Albert Einstein. You can actually go and look up the equation. It's called the Lorentz expansion factor. It's actually quite a simple little thing. It's 1 over the square root of 1 minus b squared on c squared. But that's obviously a very simple formula that's derived from special relativity, not general relativity. There are other factors in general relativity, but it basically works out to be much the same. So that's well established. But people have asked me then, if that's the case, I mean, where is Yah in the universe? And he's not in the universe. I mean, obviously, there's nothing, if you like, in the universe that would be able to have the energy to make the universe around them. So he has to be outside the universe. And they say, well, look, you know, how can one individual make such a thing? You know, look outside, where we were one tiny little speck of dust in a cosmos that's just mind-bogglingly big.
Yeah.
You know, billions and billions of stars in billions of galaxies. How can anyone have made that?
Our best estimate at this point is that galaxies average 100 billion stars and that there's over 100 billion galaxies.
Yeah, that's right.
And collectively, that only represents 6% of the energy and mass in the universe. There's 96% that doesn't even account for.
That's right. Exactly. But we don't... we're looking at it from the wrong point of view. I mean,
absolutely.
A fellow called what's his name now?
Royce. We're at the top of the hour. We're going to have the news and commercial break. I know it's very late. There's any chance you can stay with us through the news and commercial break, and we can resume this on the other side?
Yeah, sure.
Thank you.